Welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. You get two for the price of one. It's Sierra here as well as Ted. And we are here for our series on the clean energy crash course. And today we're really treating the conversation as sort of an introduction, a 101 to what's happening in the realm of sustainability and solutions in the midst of climate change. And so the context is like, you meet someone on a plane and Dad, Ted, what's going on with that? So we're gonna dive into that. And thank you for those of you tuning in. I'm delighted to be here, actually tuning in from Santa Fe, New Mexico at the moment. And Dad, you're back in California, but you've just flown in from New York. And it sounds like you were able to just barely escape the smoke that's breaking records right now, coming in from the north, from Canada. Can what the heck is going on there?
Yeah, well, first off, Sierra, it's great to be here with you, my star daughter, and these crash courses have been really fun. I think we've done five or six on a very variety of topics, and today we thought we'd just sort of bounce around a little bit. But starting off with the fires, and clearly climate change is now climate crisis. We're really past this notion of that the things may change in the future, and we're living with the repercussions now of the highest levels of CO2 in the atmosphere that we've had, in a million years. In fact, we just hit 424 parts per million. That's measured in the top of the peaks, Mauna Loa, and in Hawaii, 424 parts per million. That's 50% higher than the beginning of industrial time. So, it's a crazy time. And I did fly to New York about 8 days ago. And as you flew in, the whole East Coast is shrouded with smoke from the fires in Canada, and the winds blowing down the smoke from Canada. And crazy to think that Nova Scotia is on fire. You think of the Maritimes as being lush and moist, and but to think of the fires burning out of control there. And what happened is, you're exactly right. What happened yesterday is that the winds were such that New York received just an even more intense dosage of this smoke. In fact, I think it's on the news that New York had the worst air quality in the world, right? New York had a worser air quality yesterday than San Francisco did a couple of years ago when the fires were ravaged Northern California. So we're just seeing that the repercussions of climate change. Oh, somebody said, I love this. Somebody said this on a poster on the plane when I was flying back. It said, we don't want to import smoke from Canada. We want to import some of that good Canadian beer, So, but we're getting stuck with all of this smoke. So I think it's clear. I mean, everybody now, there's the Yale University has the Center for Climate Change Communications. Anthony Lazarowitz's shop there. And they just came out with a big survey. And the vast majority of Americans say yes, climate change is happening. Most of us are stubborn. We don't want to give up and say there's nothing that can be done. I think there's only about 2% of the people surveyed said that there's nothing that could be done at this point. So most of us are optimistic and realize that we need to make dramatic changes. But here we are. A lot of scientists have been talking about this for years. Al Gore was really raised a lot of awareness, but now that's decades ago that he did that. And here we are now worldwide experiencing climate weirding, or as I said, the climate crisis.
Right. And so you talked about 422 parts per million. Was that the number you
Well,
mentioned?
it's 424. And
Four.
you remember that Bill McKibben, my friend Bill McKibben, who runs something called 350.org. That 350 was what climate scientists thought would be the maximum concentration, that's 350 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. That's what most climate scientists thought would be the maximum before things got really out of control. And now here we are at 424 and climbing. We've been climbing for the past several years.
So that's a key threshold and boundary that we're currently breaking, and yet we remain optimistic somehow. I think, the flip side of all of this global overwhelm that we're feeling, that we're seeing, is that there is also this explosion of solutions and resilience and, looking at Earth solutions, looking at technologies, new discoveries, new ways of collaborating. So what is would you say is sort of the most exciting silver lining in the midst of this global weirding, which we all know feels super depressing and insurmountable at times, but what can pick us up out of that rut?
Yeah, and I think unfortunately, as a society, a global society, I guess things have to get really bad before they get better. And people have been saying that, it's going to take a forest fire till you have this new growth that comes in. And it's frustrating to watch how bad that it's become. But it's gotten so bad that everybody realizes that it's so bad. And now we're really starting to make changes. I'm insanely optimistic, for Oh, just like you said, we have all the solutions. There is no sh I was listening to a Dave Roberts podcast, great guy, and he said the same thing. We have all the solutions. Yes, we have to scale them up, and some of them are not cost effective yet. They will be as they scale up and as the technology matures, as you said. But our listeners should rest assured we have all of the solutions. And that's not just in the energy space, it's also in the water space and it's in the agriculture space. I mean, we're abundant in solutions, we're abundant in creative thinkers. I had Andrew McAllister, California Energy Commissioner, California Energy Commission Commissioner on the podcast, and he was just praising all the bright minds that are at work. And there's bright minds around the world at work to come up with new ways of doing things, even like new refrigerants, in heat pump systems and in chillers that are not going to damage the ozone layer, which is something that we've sort of been that's an issue that's been overshadowed. But again, there's just an abundance of solutions.
So remember, I am a passenger on a plane next to you, and I've been living under a rock. Okay, so can you just list out for me, maybe starting with the most exciting technology or renewable energy source or series of solutions, and just give me the super high level, because I hear solar sort of getting quite a buzz. And then I'm seeing these giant wind turbines coming right out of the ocean. So can you just help me understand sort of at a very high level, what is the laundry list of solutions that we're looking at?
Yeah, I think it kind of helps me when I think about energy and the environment to break the issue into maybe three parts. And the electricity sector has always been about a third of global emissions. Places like California, we're a lot less than a third because we've cleaned up our grid. But I'll talk about that in a second. But the electricity sector, there is so much going on right now. And we'll get into some of the
Or
things.
how we power our devices.
Well, then you get into, yeah, that's powering our devices. It's our lighting, it's our heating, I mean,
Or
cooling.
our cars.
It's right now, it's our cars. Another third here is mobility, is transportation. And we've relied on oil for 99% of our transportation energy for the past, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years. And we'll talk about the explosion of EVs. They're just fun to drive. It's just a better technology. It's a better technology. And really the tougher sector, the last third, is sort of energy used in our buildings and used in our industries. And so but even within industry, there's a whole movement to green steel making, right? Making steel in a green way. So, but I want to go back to the electricity just for a second, because
That's one third.
I am so
One third
excited.
of the demand and one third of the impact, would you say?
Yes, I would say generally. Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And but on the electricity side, what really is exciting me is offshore wind. And you know, there's a professor in Stanford, Mark Jacobson. He was also on our podcast, and he's got something called the Solutions Project. And he's now developed carbon-free solutions plans for like 115 countries, right? And in every case, he's figured out how do you get there. And you're basically adding up, you know, all sorts of renewable resources, onshore wind, solar, different kinds of solar, community solar, household solar, utility scale solar, hydropower, geothermal power, biomass energy. But the very biggest source of energy that Mark would say is giving him reason to be confident that we can get through this is offshore wind. The reality is that onshore wind, the wind only blows part of the time. You know, we have these great passes here in California. You know, everybody's seen the pictures of the San Gregorio Pass near Palm Desert, the Altamont Pass up in the near the Bay Area, the Tehachapi Pass in between. These are areas where the wind is just rushing through in the morning and rushing through in the evening, but really nothing's happening in the middle of the day, nothing's happening at night. It turns out that in the middle of the country, in our country out in the Great Plains, the wind is blowing at night a lot. And so there's a lot of wind development in Iowa and places, the Dakotas. I flew over a lot of turbines yesterday. You could look down and see them. But the wind is only basically blowing at night in a significant way. But offshore wind, when you get a few miles offshore and you get a several hundred feet up into the air, it's blowing all of the time. So we're looking at a situation where it may well be that about 60% of global energy comes from offshore wind in the not too distant future. And these wind turbines are being built as fast as they can. And another big development related to that is that, you know, it used to be that you could only put offshore wind in places where you've got a continental shelf, or you're in the North Sea, around the UK, in the United Kingdom, in Europe. Those are areas where the waters are relatively shallow, you know, less than a couple hundred feet deep. And so you can actually take a wind turbine, you can have a tower, just like an offshore oil rig. You can have a, you know, it's fixed to the sea bottom. But as I've written about in a lot of our newsletters, there's this new floating technology. And everybody thought that was crazy. Can you imagine floating a wind turbine that's like, you know, 100 and something feet tall? How do you do that and tethering it to the seafloor? But that is now happening all over the world. And in California, we've just leased out, you know, three big areas for offshore wind. And it will all be floating wind technology. So there's just so much going on with that offshore wind. And of course, you know, the challenge is how can you manufacture these turbines? How can you build all the port facilities to have the support for that whole infrastructure? But as we look around the world, it's just happening really, really fast.
You said, is Mark Jacobson projecting that 60% of our future electricity could come from offshore wind? So I would have thought you would have said solar.
You know, solar is just is I can't remember the exact numbers. I think it varies, of course, by country. But you know, solar was in the 10-15% range. So
Total global electricity.
solar is I love solar, as you know, it's our business, but it's a very soft form of electricity production. I mean, if you had a pipeline, you know, think of a pipeline that maybe has an aperture, maybe an opening, you know, maybe it's a 3 foot in diameter pipeline. You think about putting oil through that. You think about how many BTUs of energy are going through if it's oil. And then, oh, that's a lot, you know. And then you think about putting natural gas through it, which is much less dense. And so you have significantly less. And then you think about rushing wind through that. And again, it's way less than, you know, oil or natural gas in terms of its potential. And then you think about solar, these photons of light filtering through a pipeline, and it's kind of ridiculous. It's a very, very soft form. So it's not, we don't see solar having the kind of punch that we need. You know, it's obviously a very important resource, but wind is a very strong source of energy. It's been proven. It's very
So it
clean.
has more intensity, and you know, our systems and the way that our global economy works is very intense and energy intensive. I mean, do you honestly think that renewables can replace fossil fuels in powering the intensity of our current systems?
Yes, I do. I do. And I think a lot of experts would agree with me that it's completely possible. Now, it may be more expensive, right? It may take take some time to bring that down, but absolutely. Now, we got to go back to our neighbor Amory Lovins, the founder of Rocky Mountain Institute. We've got to become more efficient as a society. We've got to tighten up our homes. We've got to, make sure that all of our lighting systems are super efficient. So first, we shrink the amount of power that we need, and then we provide that power with renewables.
So we've gotten to one third the electricity. So now are we ready to move to the mobility third of the pie?
Yeah, I've got a bet with with a good friend of mine back in New York that we'll all be driving EVs in 5 years. He told me that I was a, crazy Californian saying that, but there's an explosion of EVs, and once anybody drives an EV, they don't ever go back. EVs are getting over 300 miles in range now. There's so many competitors to Tesla. Teslas are great. They're expensive. There's all sorts of competitors. There's trucks that are being made. There's semis that are being made. There's trains that are being shifted over to hydrogen fueled trains, which is a function of using electricity to split water and to create hydrogen. So,
Right. So when we say mobility, we're talking about internal combustion engines. We're talking about airplane fuel. We're talking about train infrastructure. We're talking about how we humans get around the planet.
yeah, it's kind of funny to think of a vehicle, think of a plane being a vehicle or a bus or a train, but in jet, yes, they are. They're all forms of moving people and moving goods. And there's not a single area within that realm of mobility where there aren't 100% carbon-free solutions.
That's fantastic. So what's the time horizon though on this? We've sort of seen the advent of the electric top car, then it was suddenly killed the electric car. Now we've had this resurgence. It feels a little bit too late in the game, but can we really kind of get our act together in the next 5 years, like you have put money on?
Yeah, I have a big $100 on this,
Ooh.
but I probably should up my ante here because I'm sure I'm going to win. It's an explosion. The number one car, the number one selling car in the world right now is an EV, right? It's the Tesla Model Y. It is the most popular car in the world. And you go to you look at countries like the United Kingdom, we're phasing out cars. California is the internal combustion engine, I should say. Many states have now done that, different countries. The EV markets are just going wild. And why is that? Well, first, it's a potentially clean technology if it's paired with renewables, but it's also a superior technology. The internal combustion engine is not very efficient. A lot of its energy is given off as heat, and a lot of its energy is given off as noise, you drive. Now, I've been driving an EV for what, 5, 6 years? It was entertaining. I took my EV in a number of years ago to the dealer. I said, "This needs a tune-up," and the sales guy said, "No, it doesn't." I said, "Well, I haven't given a tune-up in years." He said, "Well, you don't need to tune up an EV. I have zero maintenance on my EVs, right? Zero maintenance." And then the cost of mobility is so much cheaper because the electric motor is about 80% efficient. The internal combustion engine is about 15% efficient, maybe 20% efficient. So you've got an enormous efficiency gain. And then I'm thrilled that where I live in Glendale, California, where we have a very large Armenian population, and the Armenians, the ones that I know, generally are not that concerned about the environment, but they love electric vehicles. And why is that? Because they're incredibly sporty to drive. They zip around. It's really fun. You've got extraordinary acceleration, extraordinary control. So again, I think it's not just the change of fuels, but it's also that the technology is just is just plain better in a number of ways. So it's happening really, really fast.
And there are, of course, repercussions and issues of rare earth minerals that, are finite resources. And we're also working on that side of things, right? Because I think that gives the EV world a little bit of a bad rep, that there are other environmental damages that go along with being batteries powered. There's also, where is the electricity coming from? Because if it's coming from a coal fire plant, I don't know what's worse, a coal fired electric car or a fossil fuel driven car.
There's a couple of thoughts that come to mind. And one is that you're right about the rare earth materials that are used, in the clean energy sector. But within EVs and within batteries of EVs, there, really concerns about that. And if we're sourcing lithium from countries that are politically unstable, or we're sourcing lithium, which is a finite resource, that really could be problematic. The battery experts that I talk to are really intriguing me, because there are the smartest people in the world are trying to figure out the better battery chemistries. And when I say better, better would be, cradle to grave. Where do you get the materials to produce them? How do you repurpose these materials, or recycle these materials? And so I think we're going to see. My prediction is that, and I had a battery expert on the podcast a couple weeks ago, who said he thinks it'll take a little bit longer than I do to transition from lithium ion, which is the predominant battery that has fueled the rise of electric vehicle, to other forms of batteries that are more environmentally benign, and that their life cycle analyses are such that
Right.
they don't have the impacts. But again, the recycling of all these materials, some of the brightest minds from Tesla sort of recognize, my God, there's going to be an awful lot of old batteries out there. What's going to happen with them? So there's a lot of effort going into the recycling of batteries. And so that's not just how do you recycle a battery, but how do you design a battery from the start so that at the end of its life, it can be repurposed, right?
And I know Dr. Sanchez, who teaches design of renewable energy course at the Harvard Extension School, which my sister and I both support with, is very excited about sodium ion batteries. So it seems like there's this whole other world of innovation happening within the life cycle circularity aspect of this technology. Well, are there any other kind of pieces to the mobility slice of the pie that you want to mention before we move to the third of buildings and industry?
I liked what you said about, if you have an EV but you're powering it with coal, that's not so great, right? Because I'm an anti-nuclear force, I would also say that if you've gotten rid of your oil-fired, your internal combustion engine, and replace it with an EV that's relying on nuclear power, that you haven't, in my mind, you have not really created a long-term sustainable and safe solution. So we absolutely need to pair our EVs with solar and renewables. If you've really done a good job of making your home more efficient, like we have, and you've got some roof space, I mean, we have a solar system up on a roof, as you know. It's powering the cars. It's a really nice combination, right?
Right. So if you can kind of create this bouquet of sources, and it very much depends on where you are, and what the, policies are and what the environmental conditions are. Some places are much more conducive to geothermal. And then, before we leave this subject, I just have to ask, there is a pretty strong argument in the environmental space that nuclear can and must be used as a bridge energy source, because though, like you said, it's not long-term sustainable safe from what we've seen, it does have drastically fewer carbon emissions. So from a climate change perspective, many people think that it's it's an absolute must intermediary solution. Do you think we can scale up non-nuclear renewables in time in this what's been called this decisive decade, or do we need to kind of lean back on some of this technology, which arguably is getting much safer?
Well, I do believe that we have to leapfrog to real solutions and that we don't have time to even have these bridging fuels. But the nuclear, I've debated nuclear for, gosh, I guess about 40 years of my life. I used to work for the New York Power Authority, and we had a nuclear reactor up at Indian Point. Power Authority still does have a reactor there. If that reactor had an accident like Fukushima, the Fukushima accident, where and the cooling system gets knocked out for one reason or another, or it has an accident like Chernobyl, the entire New York City would have to be evacuated forever. I mean, for at least 40, 50, 60 years, right? So that's just a ridiculous concept, right? It's a ridiculous risk to take, I believe. Amory Lovins, I would consider my greatest mentor. Said using nuclear power to produce electricity is like using a chainsaw to cut butter. I mean, it is not an appropriate technology. It is a technology that is super, super high tech. And when you really look at American society, you'll find out that most of our energy is wasted, right? Lights are being left on, buildings are being overcooled, overheated. There's a tremendous amount of waste in our society. So we're using a super, super dangerous, super, super high tech resource in nuclear to power a grossly inefficient society. And so, I don't think we need to go there. And what we're finding now is that the cost of wind and the cost of solar have come down so far that they're far less expensive. We just fired up a new nuclear power plant in the United States. It's Vogtle down in, I think it's in Georgia. It's the most expensive power plant in the country. I mean, by far, right? But we can install solar at a fraction of the cost, wind at a fraction of the cost. So these technologies are not only cost effective, are not only environmentally beneficial, but they're really cost effective. So I did want to point out that the International Energy Agency, which is in Paris, just came out with one of their energy outlook or energy investment reports. And this year and for the past 3 years, there's been more investment in renewables than there has been in fossil fuels. That's globally, right? Right. And that has been going on. For every dollar that goes into the fossil fuel industry today, there's $1.70 being spent on renewables.
Wow.
Take this, cut it in another way. There's more money going into solar right now than is going into oil.
Well, and you made mention of that too. Like it may look more expensive now. It might look more expensive in the current economic framework that we're living in, but it's really pay now or pay later. I mean, we can't afford to not make this transition. For the survivability of humanity and of course all life on planet Earth. So we've gotten through two-thirds of the climate change energy intensity pie, and we have now buildings and infrastructure, right?
Yeah, in manufacture and in industry.
Industry. So I'm thinking, so I guess not trucks so much, but I'm thinking, imports and exports and
Well, and how do you make cement, which is responsible for about 3% of global emissions? And how do you make steel, which is responsible for about 3% of global emissions? And by the way, there's a lot of focus now on data centers because we as a society are storing more and more and more data, most of which will never be accessed, never be looked at all. But the data storage is in terms of greenhouse gases is almost about to eclipse all of aviation. Can you imagine that? Think of all the planes, of all the fuels in aviation right now. And think about these data centers. Which are, and not to mention Bitcoin mining, which is using a tremendous amount, but those are data centers also. So we need to rethink, how do we, first off, with data, do we need to collect all that data? Probably not.
Right.
What's a smart way of just collecting what exactly precisely we need instead of this massive brute force solution of collect everything and see if we need it later? Steel, there's a lot of focus, and Bill Gates has been really involved in this on reformulating how you make steel. And there's, even something called green steel and new techniques that I'm really not particularly versed in. The same with cement making. So there's all these new industrial processes that are sort of shaking the norm, shaking the way we've always done it. And people have said, well, this is the way we've always done it, so we have to continue. No, we need to rethink about how we make stuff. Do we really need that much stuff in the first place? We are a highly consumeristic society. We've had that whole planned obsolescence going on in our manufacturing industry for a long time. Manufacturers make stuff so that it'll break in 5 or 6 years. So you got to buy something else. Well, that's ridiculous, right? We should be building durable goods. We should be repurposing things, recycling things. So there's a lot going on in that last third. It's the most complex third. It's all about the stuff in our lives.
Which isn't really doing us a service either, having the excess and the consumerism, it doesn't lead to happiness. And I think, for a lot of people, maybe buying things and consuming is a bit of a coping mechanism. Like all this feels really, really overwhelming. And we talk about some of these forces, the fossil fuel industries and lobbyists and, the forces that are really profiting on the depletion of the planet. And it really comes down to humans, right? Like this starts with some kind of a mindset shift. So for folks listening who maybe aren't engineers and are going to work to go and, the wind turbine, design or manufacturing space, or maybe who aren't necessarily working closely with this stuff or have even too much of an understanding for it, what are some things, some easy changes, lifestyle enhancements that people might consider to just get started in being part of some of these solutions.
I mean, bringing it right down into your own home. I can't remember who it was I interviewed that said that, about 70% of decisions that are going to be affecting us in terms of the environment are made around the kitchen table. What are we going to buy? Are we going to buy that new 55-inch TV? Are we going to, what are we going to buy now? Where are we going to, what kind of car are we going to buy? Where are we going to travel? All of these decisions are around a kitchen table. And I think the kitchen table is really important because it's kind of there that we get right down to quality of life. That's what really what we're talking about. We do need to make a shift, and I know I'm eluding your question, but we need to make a shift from thinking that our quality of life is based on how much stuff we have, right? And how much material goods that we have. That needs to be replaced with how do we feel? Like, have we gotten rid of the anxiety in our lives? Are we anxious? Are we comfortable with our friends and our colleagues? Do we feel like we've made a positive contribution? I just wrote in the last newsletter, I wrote about intentional communities, which is, it's about designing communities so that we feel good, that we are with neighbors. We have diversity in terms of age and gender and ethnicity and in terms of land use. So we really need to start thinking about how we can, again, shift from that materialistic. And when I say materialistic, it's incredibly energy intensive, incredibly carbon intensive. We need to shift from that to recognizing that health and wellness comes from other stuff, and it comes from other ways of leading life. So, what does that mean? Well, I mean, you asked about what in our homes. I mean, isn't it shocking how much time people are spending watching television in their homes? I mean, it's a crazy number. You're sitting in front of that TV, probably in an air-conditioned room, eating junk food. How fulfilling is that, right? How about, getting out for a walk? How about volunteering in your community? How about playing the guitar, making music, making art? You and I know these are so much more fulfilling, right? So it's just critical that people start to become aware of what can make them really happy. And I think everybody who's a parent does not want to leave a polluted planet for their kid. So how guilty our generation already feels and will feel, my generation and the generation before us already feels about the mess that we've made, right? No, we want to make a transformation so that we have a society and an earth that's comfortable and healthy for people to live on. So get out there and get exercise. Eat lower on the food chain. Eating lower on the, people love their steak dinners and all that. Okay, periodically, that's a wonderful thing to do, but it's not healthy, and it's not healthy for the planet. So we need to find ways of lowering our carbon footprint and our nitrogen footprints, lowering our footprints that are really fulfilling for us.
Yeah, I think, really at the most fundamental level, we are part of life on this planet, right? And so it's with all of this stimulation, it's easy to tune out. But I think, like what you're saying, is it starts with us tuning in to ourselves and to the places that we are, to the earth around us, and daring to listen. And sometimes it's uncomfortable, some of the state of the world and the health of the planet or the lack of health. But I think we each have a choice to make in terms of what story we're committed to. For me, I talk about, is it this degenerative trajectory that is life depleting, or is it this regenerative trajectory where we're uncovering new solutions, we're building new collaborations, we're healing old wounds. So I think it really just starts with each one of us seeing our important role in this complex moment that we're in. Learning about these issues, you don't need to be an expert in this stuff to get involved. Finding out, what is available around you, the database for state incentives, and what is it? Desire. Database for state incentives, resources, something or other.
I think a renewable energy and
And
energy.
renewable energy, you can find out in your state what programs are available to you, whether it's solar or compost or rainwater collection, or just do it yourself. And get in touch with us because we really want to support everybody to be part of this regenerative story and economy that we're creating.
Yeah, I'd like
What
that.
else would you say to someone on the plane, Dad?
Well, I like this. Eco motion has a trademark term. It's the power of the increment, and I really think that you mentioned that each one of us sort of needs to reach into our own souls, and to recognize our responsibility in this global crisis that we're in. Let's just call it a crisis right now. The flip side of that awareness is that each of us has the power to make change, and the incremental change. It may seem very small, but it's like a sneeze or a laugh. It's contagious, right? It has a rippling effect, and it really feels good. So the power of the increment is just the opposite of this tragedy that we're experiencing. That it feels good. People recycle, not because they're going to make money, but they're chipping in. They're part of the solution. They're doing their small bit. I always love to. I know we're running out of time here, but I always love to talk about making right-hand turns, because it's got to be the simplest thing you can do. So imagine if you're going out, you're driving, you've got to go out and you've got to run a few errands, say. If you map your route making a lot of left-hand turns, you're going to be waiting at stop signs or traffic lights, waiting for the light to turn. And it's going to take you longer to do that. And your car or truck, whatever it is going to use more fuel. So if you start making right-hand turns, it turns out that it's quicker, it's more fuel efficient, it's safer to do that. And so it's just, I mean, that's just a great example of just an
So simple.
incredibly simple thing to do. And by the way, all the delivery services, UPS and FedEx, they all make right-hand turns. They are programmed to make right-hand turns because they're saving about 5% on fuel and about 5% on their time and their costs. So, but even before you go out to, start making right-hand turns, what about making a list? A lot of people go out shopping multiple times a week to the same store. Well, If you make a list, maybe you can, have go only go once a week, right? So you're just being more organized can help us reduce our carbon footprint and have more time to do your Tai Chi or practice your guitar or whatever it is that you happen to do.
So isn't that ironic that the really the way to speed up and to fortify this new story and this new movement of solutions is actually just to slow down? So thank you everyone so much for tuning in to today's conversation. We will be diving much deeper into some of the topics that we just glazed over and many others in our Energy Crash Course series. My name is Sierra, and I'm here with Ted Flanagan for Flanagan's EcoLogic podcast. And it's a delight to be with you, Father. Thanks for
No, thank you.
conversation.
I think you're my favorite moderator.
I think I might be your only
Thanks,
moderator.
everybody, for listening in.
Thank you so much.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's EcoLogic. We'll see you next time.